This week, our guest takes us inside the mind of a self-described perfectionist and planner whose plans are ruined and whose life is turned upside down when she's betrayed by the last person she'd ever suspect. The story is one of lying, betrayal, and infidelity, but it's also a story of true love, compassion, and forgiveness. Welcome to My Crazy Divorce.
I'm a failure as a husband. I'm a failure as a man.
It's just, I'm beautiful and I'm bright and I deserve better.
It's a great day, I'm feeling good. Oh, the possibilities of what I could. Oh, do with the world at my fingertips. My imagination brings a smile up to my lips. Oh.
Welcome to My Crazy Divorce, everyone. I'm your host, Tom Milligan. You know, every week, our guests share some of the most painful experiences and memories of their lives. And every week, I do my best to share those stories in a respectful but also entertaining way. I mean, let's face it, you're listening right now because you find the show entertaining, right? And it's the crazy that makes it entertaining, whatever the crazy is. But let's never forget that our guests are real people with real emotions who are sharing real stories for no real reason other than to help you avoid the pain they've been through. Before we get to this week's story, I have just a couple of things to tell you. First, remember that I'm not an attorney or a therapist, so nothing on this show should ever be mistaken as legal or therapeutic advice. Please seek out the appropriate professional if you need that type of support. And if you have a crazy divorce story you'd like to share on our show, regardless of your motivation, please visit mycrazydivorce.com and click on the Apply to be a Guest button. It only takes a minute to apply, and I would love to hear from you. Okay, this week, we're going up north, all the way to Canada, to meet Tess, and to find a brand of crazy we've never had on this show. So, dress warm, strap in, and hold on tight. Tess, thank you so much for being here. I'm excited to hear your story today.
Thanks, Tom. I'm excited to share it.
I mentioned that you're up in Canada. Where do you live now?
So we're actually in Nelson, British Columbia, but grew up and probably moving back to the Lower Mainland, so near Vancouver, just outside of Vancouver in BC.
Tell us about your childhood. Let's start with, where did you grow up?
I was actually born in Langley, where I actually lived most of my adult life until just this past year. So born and raised there. My parents were separated pretty much by the time I was a year old. So I grew up in sort of a divorced family with my dad being remarried and my mom being with her own partner as well for basically my entire life. That's what I knew.
Okay. How about siblings?
Yeah, I have two older brothers who both also live in Langley. So we're all, our family has pretty much stayed there our entire lives. Yeah.
So you have two older brothers that share your parents. They're, you know, your parents had three kids together before they separated.
Yeah.
Are you close with your brothers?
I am. Yeah, I'm close with my brothers, still close with my dad, but I'm estranged from my birth mom. We don't speak anymore since I was pretty much a young adult. I had to unfortunately cut her out of my life just due to her toxic behavior.
I understand that. Everyone who listens to the show knows that I've been married a couple of times, and my first wife, her father was an interesting character. And again, I won't go into great detail other than to know that we were married when she decided to cut off her relationship with him. And so I actually watched.
Oh, wow.
Even though it's toxic and she knew it was the best thing that she needed to do for her, it still hurt. So I can only imagine.
Yeah, I don't think any child wants to be estranged from their parent, right? It's like an animalistic instinct to want to like maintain that attachment to them.
Absolutely. But kudos to you for having the strength to to know that you needed to get out, or whatever the right verb is.
Yeah.
Okay, so religion.
I sort of, I would say, like, dabbled in Christianity throughout high school. I went to a couple youth groups and found sort of a community in almost like a little family there. There was a youth group that was started in my high school, and it wasn't like traditional Christianity that was very like by the book. It was very kind of like a modern Christian type group where it was more just like teachings about life, how to be a good person. But eventually, like as I got older, that sort of piece of my life kind of dropped out. But I created more of like a spiritual practice and still like believe in things like that, but I don't attend church or anything regularly.
Okay. So you had it sounds like your experience with religion was positive.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Not like what you sometimes hear from some people. And both of my parents were not religious at all. So none of that was like passed on through them.
Well, let's learn about your husband. His name is Tori. So let's learn about Tori. Did Tori also grow up in Langley?
He actually was born on the East Coast of the U.S. in Maryland, and traveled around quite a bit up until the age of 13. His dad had to relocate a lot for work, and so he was sort of always moving around every few years. So I think that was pretty hard on him, not being able to really establish roots and long-term friendships and that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. That's hard on any kid. Mm-hmm. His family, parents stayed married or?
Yeah, they did stay married, and they still are, in fact. His dad had to go away a lot for work, and so although he was present in his life, he was predominantly raised by his mom, and he also has a younger sister as well that he's still close with.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so he moved to Langley when you guys were teenager.
He was about, like probably 13, I think, was when he moved there to BC. Okay. Yeah.
How did you guys meet then?
Mm-hmm. So we met, I was actually previously married when I was 21. It was like a high school sweetheart type arrangement. You know, we thought it was like the first person I'd ever been with, my first love, all those things. We were together for like 7 years all through high school. And then a year after we got married, I realized like the next sort of step was like having kids. And I was like, oh no, like this is not the right match for me. Like we weren't in alignment. We had grown apart. And so I had been actually recently divorced. And about 6 months later, a coworker of mine introduced me to Tori through my work. And so we had met, which sort of felt like this odd time for me because I, you know, as much as it was done and in the past, that first marriage, it was a lot to go through at such a young age, right? And, you know, you still have those sort of bliss ideas that, you know, you're going to get married and stay together forever. And I think I was still in the midst of that dream, like being crushed and really that reality sinking in. So when I met Tori, it was great. We went out to lunch. Super attracted to him, super nice guy. But I was very much on the fence of like jumping into some sort of relationship at that point.
Well, let me ask you about that. So how old were you when you were first married then?
So I was 21 when we officially tied the knot.
So you were all the way through high school, you were with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say you were together for 7 years, you mean by the time you split up? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, by the time we split up.
And so you'd been together a few years when you got married.
Just 1 year, actually. Well, like we had been together, yes, for I think 6 years, and then we were only married for a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, so your divorce goes through, and I admittedly know a lot about divorce in the U.S. I don't know anything about divorce in Canada. So does it take a long time?
It really depends, I think, how amicable the two people are. So we never had to go to court, thankfully. We did it all through a solicitor up here. It's so funny because you always think, and I'm sure you know, Tom, from your experience, but you always think you know somebody until their ego is bruised, right? And the ending of that marriage was really put forward by myself. And so he felt like I think a lot of men typically do, like blindsided when really you've been saying things maybe for years and years and years. And so he was obviously very hurt from that. And then going into sort of divorce and separation agreements and who was keeping what and money, you know, the worst of people come out. And so it was pretty bad for a little bit, but thankfully, we were able to sort of settle, and with enough money, I was able to end that chapter of my life.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and so you move on. And, yes. I know, and we're not here to talk about that divorce. So I just wanted to get that little part of it out there. So you're divorced. Mm-hmm. And then how long after that did you meet Tori?
About 6 months later. So okay. I was divorced by the spring of, that'd be 2012, I guess. And so I met Tori in October of that same year.
Okay. So we're talking about 2012. You meet Tori, you're set up or introduced at least by a friend at work. And so how old were you guys at that point? You were 22, 23?
Yeah. Okay.
And he's your same age?
He's technically like a year younger than me.
Oh, ooh.
I know, right? It's like 8 months or something like that.
Yeah. What do we use? Cradle robber or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's funny.
That's me.
Yeah. That's great. Okay. So you immediately felt attracted to him and I assume the feeling was mutual.
Yes. I think Tori was in hot pursuit after the first lunch.
Hot pursuit. That's great. You know, it's interesting. I have, and many people have heard me say this, one of the first three or four episodes of this show, we had J.D. McCabe on, who has also written a book, by the way.
Okay.
And the advice portion of the show, he gave the advice that you should have a list of immediate deal breakers and must haves before you get into a relationship. Do you? When we finish that show, there's a lot of stuff that I do. When you and I finish recording, there's a whole checklist of things that I do.
Yeah.
I said, forget all of those. And I started my list. And I have my list. And I literally just added to it the other day that if I meet somebody and she's divorced, she must be divorced for at least 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say
I would concur.
So when you're on the fence, you're saying that you met Tori and you were on the fence. I assume that was part of it. Is that like, holy crap, I just finished a divorce. Yeah. What happened if you were so on the fence? How did you get through it?
Well, you know, I think I had started dating, nothing serious. And I was kind of feeling a bit discouraged, maybe. Like, you know, you have some doubts, like, oh, did I make a mistake? Should I have stayed in that marriage? You know, it was okay. Like, nothing traumatic happened. It was actually really hard for people to understand why I left. Like, that whole we just fell out of love or we grew apart doesn't satisfy people's curiosity. And so I had a lot of doubts at that point, like maybe I made a mistake. What was I doing? And when I met Tori, he was just like very different than my first husband. I think my first husband was not like my mom, but just like emulated the same type of sort of behavior. Like he made the rules and that kind of stuff. And it's interesting because there's so much stuff about child psychology, how we tend to marry people like our primary caregiver and all of that, right? It's like a little wound we have. Mm-hmm. And so when I met Tori, I was more on the fence because like he was so kind and he was almost like too sweet. And you know, it's like, well, I wanted someone that was kind of like mean and rude to me. Like that's what I was used to growing up and in my first relationship. And you know, just even like a different, like he was blonde and like I dated guys with brown hair and like all of those things, right. But you know, he was very persistent and gave me the space that I needed, but really didn't like walk away from us. And so
that's a fine line to walk then.
Yeah he was very patient, you know. And even being that fresh out of a divorce, like obviously there's still emotions that would come up at some points, and he would very much like help me through those and support me, which would be very odd for, you know, someone who's like just trying to date someone and now they're talking to you about their ex in a very emotional way. It just showed a lot of like his character and who he was, and I felt really safe with him. And my list, like your previous interview and the one you've made, was after that first marriage, you know, I came to the understanding that no partner is ever going to be perfect. They're not going to check all the boxes for you. But for me, it's like, what were my non-negotiables? Like,
right. Like
what were the things I could not compromise on? And one was like a kind heart, someone who was really supportive, and just like that kindness piece, like that was really top on the list, because like I didn't want to go into some sort of, you know, emotional abusive type relationship again. And he had all of those qualities. And so with some persistence, he won me over and I agreed to start dating him. And we never really looked back after that.
Well, that's great. So
yeah.
How long did you date?
We dated for about a year and a half, I would say.
Okay.
So it was pretty fast. Like,
well, a year and a half is actually, you know, we've had it all on this show. We've had people that got engaged within 3 weeks of meeting. Wow. Of meeting.
Wow.
And then others who dated for years and years. So I think a year and a half is, I'm trying to think, it's probably one of the longer ones, actually.
Okay. Well, there we go. That makes me feel better. Yeah.
But so you dated for a year and a half.
Yeah.
Obviously, things were going well or you wouldn't have stayed dating. So,
Yeah, life was really fun. We both were starting our careers, moved in together, you know, enmeshment of our friend groups, all of those things, like kind of picture perfect in all of those ways. Yeah.
Yeah. How long did you date before you moved in together?
Let me think. It was probably like 7 or 8 months.
Okay. Yeah, I actually have a very close friend who moved in with his girlfriend like literally 3 weeks after they met.
Wow.
And they just broke up last week.
Oh.
Shocker. Okay. So.
Divorce doesn't have to be complicated. Our Divorce.com's 3-step procedure provides a simple and affordable process that you can follow at your own pace. Save thousands by visiting ourdivorce.com today.
Okay. And then so you're dating for 6 or 7, 8 months, then you move in together, then you live together for another 8, 9, 10 months, whatever that is, and then you get married or you get engaged.
Yeah. Tori planned a surprise weekend to Whistler, which is the Olympics were there. So I'm sure everyone knows where that is in Vancouver. And a horse-drawn carriage ride later in the snow. It was like very picturesque, like picture-perfect moment. And he got down on one knee and said a whole bunch of things to me that are hard to recall now. But in the moment, they were all the right things and asked me to marry him.
And I bet he's wishing he had them recorded too, because that's...
Yeah, there was some tears in the middle, so...
That's really great. Was it a surprise to you at all?
I had a suspicion, just like, Tori isn't the best planner, so like you could feel like his stress in trying to organize all these things. And the day we were leaving, like I obviously knew then we were going somewhere, like bags were packed, but he actually had planned like a helicopter proposal. Like you can rent helicopters up there and they land on the glacier on top of the mountain, but it had like a storm had rolled in. And so the company had called him like while we were driving up and they were like, yeah, we're not going to be able to fly you out. It's too dangerous. And so then, you know, panic sets in. I'm sure for a guy, it's a lot of pressure to feel like this is this big monumental moment and it has to be perfect. You know what you see in the movies. And so plan B had to begin. And so I could sense something was up, but I wasn't, you know, 100% convinced that's what was happening.
Wow. That sounds fun. Yeah. I don't have any stories like that. So I'm almost jealous. Okay. So he does this, what I will say is a pretty cool, even though it was plan B, that's a pretty cool engagement.
Yeah, I tell him he still owes me a helicopter ride, but we'll see.
All right, so Tess, you and Tori just have this wonderful engagement story. How long were you engaged?
We were engaged for, let's see, January, so only 6 months. We got married that summer. We got engaged in January, and we were married by August.
Okay, 6 or 7 months then. So was it a big wedding? Was it everything you ever dreamed of?
Well, I mean, it was different because I'd been married before. And, you know, I think especially the first time you want it to be the whole dream you've thought of since you were a little girl. And I knew, though, that this was Tori's first time getting married. And although I had been married before, it felt different this time because it just felt like I knew more of who I was and we felt more in alignment. And so we still did like the big charade, and there was like 120 people there at a big golf course, and all of that, and it was amazing.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So and families got along, everybody was just as happy as could be. So now at this point you've been together for a couple of years when you got married, and everybody's happy, you guys, it's marital bliss, and you, at that point, your careers were going okay, money was okay, and
Yeah. Our careers were taking off. We were in the process of, you know, we got married in 2014. And later the next year, we were buying our first home together. And we wanted to start having babies right away. So we were progressing through things quickly. The checklist.
Checking off the boxes, exactly. So is that what happened? Started having kids?
Yeah, I think, you know, backing up a second, I had mentioned earlier, like, that I was estranged from my mom. And, like, one of the things I learned throughout my childhood was, like, through conditioning, I think, is if I was perfect all the time, like, I could get attention and love from her. Mm. And I took a lot of that behavior into my adulthood, especially into my, like, intimate relationships. And so when I was divorced originally, it really felt like a failure to me, like, in my life, like, I wanted to have this picture perfect life, almost in, like, redemption for the childhood I had had with her. And so I think when I met Tori, as much as I did love him and all of that was real in it, I think subconsciously it also felt like, okay, this is my second shot. Like, I got to do it all. Like, what society says is the picture perfect life, the successful marriage, you do this, you buy the house with the white picket fence and you have the babies and da 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 da, da, yeah. And you have this great career and things are great.
And you have a dinner on the table when Tori gets home from work. And
yes. And I was a full caregiver to my mother. I found, like, I could evade, like, punishment from her. Like, she was very emotionally and physically abusive if I was, you know, caregiving for her. And so I very much played a caregiver role in my previous marriage as well as my relationship with Tori, because in a way I was codependent. Like, I needed people to need me. Right. So very much, like, right away, as soon as, even before we got married, I was like, I was the cook, I had an amazing job, we were going to have babies, and I was going to, like, look amazing pregnant and all of these great things, which all came true, by the way.
There you go. Of course, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's great. It sounds like you, I mean, on the one hand, it's almost sad that you felt that you had to meet those standards, mm-hmm. but I guess kudos to you for meeting them.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of reflection now, which we'll get into probably later on, like, ooh, like, what role I played in that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, that was, it was a survival mechanism, right? I felt that that was the way, like, that people would love me and people would stay, is if I cared for them and I was perfect and all of those things. And then you build this identity of being perfect, and it's hard to ever break free from that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really fascinating thing. And one of the reasons we go back into the childhood of our guests is to understand mm-hmm. why they do what they do and why they believe what they believe. And when they get into these relationships and marriages, and I don't talk a lot about my first wife because I have, you know, I have a great deal of respect for her. Yeah. She's a great mother to our children. And that's about as far as I ever want to say, but I will say, as I mentioned earlier, she became estranged from her birth father while we were married. The other thing is that she grew up, she has a much younger brother. And so, and her stepdad, one of the greatest men I've ever met, he's ADD. Mm-hmm. And so her mother, my former mother-in-law, kind of had to, I don't want to say baby him, but she had to kind of keep him on track.
Right.
And then her younger brother was 13 years younger than she is. And so she grew up watching her mother treat all the men in her life, I don't want to say like children, but kind of helping mm-hmm. them along. So I think she had that in her head that that's how a wife is supposed to be. And yeah. So when we got married, I became the man in her life. Therefore, I needed a mother. I needed to be taken care of. I was raised to be very independent. And that was a really, it was a hard thing for me. I'm like, I don't need a mother. Thank you.
Right. Wow. Well, good for you for even noticing that, because a lot of men, I find that is a wound for them. Like, they want a wife who's like their mom, and together, like, both play into that parent-child dynamic that really is detrimental to a marriage. Like, you can't be attracted and be passionate with someone when you're emulating a parent-child relationship. It just, it never works.
Yeah. And if that does work, that's pretty gross. So, yeah. So it was a real, it took me years to realize that. I didn't realize it at the time. I just knew that I didn't like being treated like a child. I didn't understand where it came from in her life. Right. And, you know, maybe if I understood that earlier, we'd still be married. Who knows? And
who knows?
And again, no blame on her. Just, yeah. It was just a weird situation.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had that with Tori as well, where you wanted to take care of everything and you started having kids. How many kids did you end up having?
We have two. Mm-hmm. So we were pregnant and had our first daughter in 2015. And then 3 years later, we got pregnant with our second and ended up moving into like a larger home at that time. And then, yeah, we had two kids and we were in a brand new neighborhood and all of that.
And careers are going well.
Yeah, careers are going well with our second child. I actually was only home for about 3.5-4 months, and then I went back to work. My career was kind of taking off. I was going into management, and I was working very much in a man's world in engineering. And as much as I think there was support there, I felt that if I showed any weakness, like staying home for a whole maternity leave, like my job would be at risk. Oh. So I went back really quickly, which, you know, in hindsight, like I think that put a lot of strain on our relationship. We had a toddler, a newborn, and I was working full time, and so was he.
And I assume that the kids were in some sort of daycare, or did you have a nanny? Or
yeah, they were in nanny at first for the little one, and then eventually, as he got a little bit older, then they were both in daycare.
So, at this point, you've been married for, we're talking 2018, 2019. So you've been together married, or at least.
Yeah, for 4 years.
Okay, for 4 years. But together for 6 or 7 at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, life, you know, was pretty perfect at that point. Like, again, all the boxes were getting ticked. So I was feeling like I was happy. You know, we had just moved into this new neighborhood. Our community there was great. We had like, you know, the $1 million home that was beautiful. Everything was great on all of those fronts.
Wow.
Yeah.
I you know, I hate to say this, but we've just told this, you know, there were some bumps in the road, but this is this fairy tale story here. Now we have to get to the bad part, because otherwise you wouldn't be on the show.
yeah.
So something went awry.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us what happened?
Yeah. So basically our son was born. And, you know, like, as that happened, like we mentioned, I was playing this very much like caregiver role. But, you know, you add on one kid, I still had the bandwidth to like care for Tori and do all the things. And then, but you add on a second, and I was feeling like quite constrained. This is a pretty common, I think, scenario for most couples with young kids. So what ended up happening was like I didn't have the bandwidth anymore to do what I was always doing. And so Tori was kind of the first person to sort of like be sacrificed in a way, right? So I could tell that, you know, especially having a newborn and working right away, he was feeling like I wasn't giving him a lot of attention. I wasn't, like, I had to put all of it into those two babies and everything else that was going on. But again, I just assumed that was pretty typical for a couple with young kids and, you know, escalating careers. And I really did believe that our connection and the love and foundation that we had built could withstand, you know, kind of that dip, that valley that I think a lot of couples go through. And I thought, you know, like that I could tell like things were beginning to erode a little bit, but I would create like opportunity to discuss, like, are you okay? I know we're really busy. I know the kids are a lot, that sort of thing. But at the same time, I also began to build a lot of resentment for Tori because I still like my bandwidth was decreasing and I felt that he still felt entitled to this care that I had always provided him. And, you know, I'll be the first to say in those types of dynamics, and I feel like women are very guilty of this, myself included, we help to create that dynamic of this like caregiver role, and men get very used to it, or your partner, whoever it is, get used to that. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden we have kids and we're like, well, get off your ass and like get going. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like we help to create that dynamic as well. Right.
Can you kind of explain what you mean by caregiver and the dynamic that you're talking about? Is this,
yeah, of course.
Is this just cooking, cleaning? What do you mean?
Well, all of the above, yes. Cooking, cleaning, you know, the mental load of everything for the kids, like who's picking them up, doctor visits, extracurriculars, like driving to and from, planning out our social life, paying the bills, doing the finances, all of those things. And not to say that Tori would ever say no to helping, but like I had to create a list for him. But I like to call myself like a recovering control freak. I don't know if he would have stepped up if I would have actually let him. You know what I mean?
Because you never let him.
Yeah, because having control provided safety for me in my upbringing, and I carried that sort of conditioning forward into my adult life, especially in my intimate relationships. Like even with my friends, I'm the leader, the planner, all of that, right? It was a place I liked being. But you know, we're still human, and as you begin to feel like tired and stretched too thin, resentment begins to build. And that's pretty common with this like caregiver parent child dynamic that a lot of marriages can end up like. And that's why it's so toxic to like start off that way and to think that you can survive in a relationship like that as well.
I couldn't agree more, by the way. I guess my question though is, you said that you could see it happening, and so you talked to him about it. So you could feel and you recognized it in real time. A lot of people wait until a year later and go, oh shit, look what I just did, or look what he just did to me. You're saying right. You saw it in real time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I could feel him sort of begin to almost like feel abandoned by me a little bit, I would say, like, because I knew he wanted me to do all those things for him, but I knew I just couldn't. And the kids obviously couldn't care for themselves, but he was a grown adult. So I just kind of assumed like, well, just shift gears. Like now you're up to bat. Like you got to take care of yourself now. And I think, you know, it almost felt like the kids became this wedge in between us.
Yep.
Not that he didn't love them. He did. But I could tell in a way it'd be like an only child getting a sibling, right? It's like, I used to get all the attention and now you're over there dealing with like the younger one. Not that he assumed he was a child. I'm not saying that, but you could understand like the dynamic that gets created there. And, you know, I think in a way he felt like he lost his wife a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think that's pretty common. And I will say again, in my first marriage, I don't know if it was so much I lost my wife, but it was an interesting thing for her to transform from being a wife to being a mother. And mm-hmm. I think that's a hard role for women to play. To straddle the fence, to be both, because being a mother is so hard. I get it. Mm-hmm. I've never been one, but I get it, how hard that can be and the responsibilities that society and men in general put on their wives. But it, as a man, you're going, wait a minute, is she my wife anymore? Mm-hmm. And is she 50% my wife and 50% mother? In my case, I always felt that it was 99% mother. There was very little wife left for me. Right. And you know, I'm not blaming her. Again, my first marriage it's a weird story. But, you know, it all comes down to, and so I can understand where Tori would feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think, like, the intent, like, matters. It's how the person feels, right? And I think husbands understand, oh, yeah, like, she's busy, but you still feel emotionally, like, let down, hurt in a way, right? Mm-hmm. But typically we kind of just carry on, like, and I think that begins to breed like different emotions coming through. And, you know, back to the childhood trauma piece, I was a people pleaser, caregiver, perfectionist, whereas Tori, having, you know, a dad always away working and his mom busy with his younger sister, like he had a lot of abandonment issues, right? Mm-hmm. So very like anxious attachment style. And so as we began to have children, and in a way I was physically present, but emotionally unavailable to him or too tired for conversating, never mind anything else, you could begin to see how, you know, almost we were creating, I was abandoning him in that sense, right? And so for him, like, I think, like, subconsciously, like, it was like getting rewounded.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That's sadly fascinating.
Yeah. It's honestly so, like, I've done just so much digging into this stuff to understand, which we'll get into in a bit, like, how things happen in relationships. And I really do believe that so much of it stems from traumas and experiences that we've just never processed and healed from. And we don't even realize how we bring those same behaviors and coping mechanisms forward into our adult life when they no longer serve us. And in fact, I think they're really detrimental to the status of our relationships.
Yeah. I heard one time that our entire personality is just a collection of scars on our back.
Yeah, that's a good analogy for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and by the way, those can be good scars too.
Yep.
I mean, every experience that leads us to this moment is making us has made us who we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
Oh, hey, girl. It's Tess Rouse and Christina Beatty. We're the co-hosts and creators of Authentically Wild,
a podcast that may literally transform your understanding about life, relationships, and your healing journey.
So get ready, girl.
Shit's about to get wild.
Did you get this happy marriage that is starting to have some... There's some chinks in the armor a little bit, yeah. Some bumps in the road.
Yeah.
And you see him happening. You try to talk about it, but, you know, sometimes maybe he didn't even recognize it. So it's hard to talk about it if you don't even recognize it. Mm-hmm. But so then what?
Yeah. And so that was there a few months actually prior to our son being born. New neighbors had moved into our cul-de-sac, and they were a couple that was similar age to us who had kids of similar ages. And, you know, we became like best friends, especially myself and the wife. We hung out every day. And so I think in a way that friendship almost distracted me from sort of the beginning downfall of my marriage. Like, I got to spend a lot of my time and energy on this friendship where I felt like connected and supported. And, you know, women, we love to commiserate and bond over motherhood and, you know, marriage and whatever else. And so there was also that happening, but in a way, you know, life still felt perfect. It just felt like, yeah, we were going through a valley a little bit, Tori and I, but I had this great friendship and kind of this village, you know, they say like it takes a village to raise a child, like all families and everyone played together outside and we had block parties and all these things. And, you know, life in that sense, especially, you know, from the external world, looked great. You know, there was just a few things behind the closed door where it felt like we don't feel as connected anymore. But again, I just attributed that to, yeah, Tori's hurt that I'm not as attentive to him, and we're busy. We have two kids under, you know, 3 years old.
So you started having a friendship with this woman, and it sounds like you became really close. Did Tori resent the fact that you had the emotional bandwidth to become friends with her while he was over here feeling like you don't even have the emotional bandwidth to be my friend anymore? And I know you were friends. That's not what I meant, but
that's a good question. I don't know. I don't think so. Like, Tori is very much, even though like he has like this kind of like abandonment wound, his demeanor is very much like very confident, very social. And so I think in a way, them moving in and, you know, this neighborhood we'd created was almost a nice distraction for both of us. Okay. Because it, you know, it was fun. There was lots to do. You know, when you have little kids, you're not like out and about all the time. So it was like this great sort of playhouse, yeah, within like our neighborhood. So I think if anything, it sort of distracted us from focusing on where we should have been focusing, which was on our marriage, when we began to feel like those slips.
It's unfortunate. I actually used to live in a cul-de-sac that sounds a lot like yours, and we had so many, there were so many kids running around the neighborhood. Our kids, just there were always 100 kids running around, and so we called it the cul-de-sac.
I love that.
We had so much fun there. That was probably the happiest time of my life, was during that time period when the kids were, you know, 7 to 12 or whatever.
Yeah. It really does it's so nice for parents because your kids are like constantly entertained, and it's like an amazing thing. I think a lot of people were very envious of and dreamed of having.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got these great friends. Your life sounds good. It sounds like you've at least distracted from the pain or from the discomfort.
Yeah. So as you know, our son turned one, so it's been like a year now, and I began to feel Tori, like not just sort of disconnected from me, but I began to feel like a bit of like anger in him almost. Like he began to, I told you, like my list of non-negotiables was someone who was like kind and just like sweet and supportive, like my number one fan. Like when I married him, when I dated him, that's who he was to me. Mm-hmm. Like this kind soul that could never hurt me. And he began just like his demeanor and attitude towards me started to change, where he would like belittle me in front of our neighbors or kind of like get really short with me, which was not his typical behavior. Or, you know, if I was upset, instead of coming to console me, which usually he would have, he would just not come. Where he'd distract himself on his phone all the time. And so I began to see like his behavior really change. And so I knew like this was a bigger issue than I had originally thought. And we weren't obviously going up, like now that the kids were starting to get older and a bit less needy. And so we started counseling with a couple's counselor. We probably did, I don't know, like 6 or 7 months of that. And you know, he would say things like, I don't really feel like you're, you know, super passionate towards me. It feels like you're just, you know, another checklist on your list. I would say like, I don't feel like you help enough with the kids and all around the house, like all the typical things, yeah. Right? I feel like these counselors probably hear every single day. and so we would try like these different exercises and stuff. And I'd see a little bit of progress, but again, like I could feel something was off. Like it just felt like this wedge between us was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I couldn't quite place my finger on like what it was, but I began to have a really hard time with it. And again, you know, with my best friend who lived there, like I would console and confide in her about how upsetting it was. You know, what we were going through, and just like she would reassure me, like, you guys will get through it, like he loves you.
So you've been at it for a while. Now what?
Yeah, we were, you know, I was starting to see a little bit of progress. You know, we were doing like exercises outside of our meetings with the counselor and that. But it still felt like I was missing something. Like I still could feel this sort of wedge between Tori and I, and I could see he was like really happy, like socializing with other people. But towards me, there was just this like kind of anger and resentment that began sort of boiling over. I could feel like, again, I mentioned he would like belittle me in front of our neighbors and just kind of be a bit cold to me, not really console me when I was upset, that sort of thing. And it was almost like on a calendar, like once a month we'd have these major like discussions, but they were heated, like, and it'd be like right before bed, and it would be like hours, we'd be up to like 1 in the morning, and it would always end with him say, like, I would be like, what's wrong, like what's going on, like what am I not doing, like I feel like I'm doing everything and you're still not happy. And you know, it would always end with him being like, I'll try harder, like I love you, and da, da, da. So then I was like, okay, moving on. And then a month later, same kind of thing, it would come to this head. And I got so sick of that. But, you know, during that time, I continued confiding in my best friend, you know, really being quite vulnerable with her about like the issues of my marriage and, you know, almost thinking like, did I make another mistake? Did I marry someone that I shouldn't have married? And, you know, it was just really interesting because she would, you know, always support me in that. Like, no, he loves you. Like, of course not. Like, you got this. Like, everyone goes through stuff like this. And, you know, and I just felt like, yeah, okay. Like, I can do this. You know, I don't want to give up on this just because it's hard. And, yeah, so, like, we continued on. And then I began feeling like, oh, like Tori was kind of changing. Like he started doing things around the house and started really like nourishing his relationships with the kids, like doing special things for
Tori. Well, you have this best friend who's your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Was Tori and her husband, were they good friends too? Or was it really just the two of you guys?
They were friends, not as close as myself and her. So yeah, like there was definitely a friendship and we did like some family vacations together. Again, our kids were all enmeshed and friends and we even did like before and after school pickup for each other. So yeah, it was a tight knit thing, but her and I were best friends and everyone knew that. And we spent like, I don't think there was a day we didn't see each other.
Wow. Those are best friends.
Yeah, okay. Like a lot of people would say like a friendship of convenience, right? Like physically being located so close to somebody. But it wasn't just that. Like we jived really well and yeah, all those things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, we had this picture perfect marriage, but we've started to see a little bit of a we've hit a valley.
Yeah. Yeah, so like some things – I began, like I had, well, I didn't know it at the time, but it was definitely my intuition, like piping up inside me, like this little voice being like, something seems off here. I didn't like how that comment sounded. So just like some examples before I kind of get into the climax of the story, I guess, like as an example, Tori and I, again, we're in counseling, we're trying to spice things up, fix things, make sure like I was really prioritizing time between the two of us because I know how busy I was, you know, during the day with work and the kids and that. And so we had planned like a kind of a later anniversary getaway back to Whistler where we had got engaged. And I remember like going on a walk with my best friend and being like, oh yeah, we're leaving for Whistler this weekend. We're going to the spa and like all these things. And I just remember like looking at her and for like a split 10 seconds, like her face being shocked and almost upset. And I was like, oh, that was weird. But then, oh, like that's gonna be so great for you guys. Okay. Then there was like another instance, you know, and again, that moment really didn't sit well with me. Like I remember thinking that, and I like, why did her face look like that when I told her? But I was like, that's weird, whatever. You know, because like people have FOMO, like, oh, that sounds nice. I wish I could be doing that with my husband, right?
Sure.
So chalked it up to that. Maybe a few months before we had went, there was like another situation where, you know, they all came over with all their kids and it was just a lot. Imagine like five kids running about in a house and everyone's excited. And I remember saying to my husband later, oh, like so much for a peaceful night, like as a joke.
Right.
And then later that next day, she had texted me like, you know, if you don't want the kids to come over, if it's too chaotic for you, you should just tell me. And I was like, I didn't say that in front of you or to you. So then I confronted Tori, like, what, why did she know that? Oh, like, I just like mentioned it. Like, so then again, like that voice inside me, why are you sharing conversations outside of our marriage? Like, again, like that's my best friend. Like, why would there be a dialogue? Like they chatted and, you know, I didn't think anything of that, but that just seemed a bit personal to share because it's almost like, you know, me not making a joke at her, but just, you know, she would maybe be insulted by that.
Wow.
And you know, I remember even in that conversation saying like, who is your loyalty to here? Like, it just felt a bit weird. And that's really when I began to just start seeing a few more things like that. But at the same time, again, I chalked it up to Tori kind of having this hate on for me. Like there was some resentment still there, like a wedge still there. And, you know, I just assumed he was kind of like throwing me under the bus a bit. And like, that didn't sit well with me either.
Right.
But then like one fateful night and in May around Mother's Day, he did something really nice and he built the kids like a treehouse. And I just remember like watching him all day building it out in like the hot sun being like, wow, like, things are turning the corner. Like, look at him, like putting in like a whole weekend, like to make them so happy.
And he's in it for the long haul because he's not going to do that if he's right? that unhappy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then later that evening, he had like gone up to our room and I think kind of like passed out. Like he was so tired from all the construction. And I remember like going up there and just like looking at him sleeping and thinking like, aw, like just like feeling like that love and admiration for him. And then that voice came back and it was just like, fuck, like, shut up. Like, give me this moment. And it was like, check his phone. Check his phone. And I was like, why would I check my husband's phone? Like, I feel like I'd scrolled through things before, like not really looking for anything, but like, I'd found nothing. And I was like, okay, I got ready for bed and just kind of ignored it. And then like, it was like an overwhelming, like it was literally like having a person inside my head being like, check the phone. Like, you're not going to sleep. You're checking the phone. Cause it was just like laying there, right? Like not on the charger or anything. So I was like, okay, flipped it open. Yeah, saw nothing in his messages. And then like on another, like, you know, those other chatting apps, all of a sudden I see it like a conversation between him and my best friend. And I'm reading it, you know, not chronologically, I'm reading it from present, like to past. Mm-hmm. And every time I scroll a little bit more, I'm like I could feel, like I'm literally like feeling it right now in my body as I'm like telling the story that.
Me too, listening to it.
Yeah, right? Experience, it's traumatic. And, you know, reading it backwards, I had to read it like 20 times because I was so unconvinced that there was something going on between the two of them. And the messages were more like flirtation. There wasn't like, it wasn't, well, it was obvious, but it wasn't like, oh yeah, there's an affair. Like they weren't talking about it.
It was at least inappropriate.
Absolutely. But
at the very least.
Yeah. And I always refer back to this moment. My favorite movie in the world is Armageddon with Bruce Willis. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
There we go. So the moment before, you know, he like presses the button to destroy the asteroid, like his whole life flashes before his eyes. I feel like this is very common in movies. They see the every memory, every picture. And I literally had that moment where I knew right away everything that had happened because I had all these glimpses. I had all these pieces. And that was the missing piece. I hadn't figured out that I thought for like, you know, at some point in our relationship, like maybe he was having an affair and I knew there was something going on with her, but I never connected the two of them together. And it was just this overwhelming, visceral feeling in my body and this like explosion of like events and moments all coming together in an instant. And the whole picture was painted for me in that moment.
I'm sick to my stomach.
Having
been there,
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry you had to feel that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard because I think those are like really defining moments in your life, right? Like there'll never be another time. Like it's always like pre that moment and post that moment now. Like yep. It's this milestone event that has happened where everything changes after that.
Well, I just know that when I found out about mm-hmm. my now ex-wife's first affair, I fell to my knees. And what I knew was my life was never going to be the same.
Yeah.
I didn't know that we were going to try and stay married. I didn't know that I was going to forgive her. I didn't know any of that at the moment. I just knew that that moment, mm-hmm. my whole life changed.
Yeah.
And so the way you put that was absolutely perfect. So mm-hmm.
I feel anyways. That.
Did you know you can get divorced without hiring an attorney? Let OurDivorce.com guide you through our three-step process for a simple flat fee. Visit OurDivorce.com to learn more and get started today.
So what happened next? You're reading this thing. Mm-hmm. Your life flashes before your eyes. And now what?
Yeah, it was sort of this like out-of-body experience. I'd never felt, you know, and I'd given childbirth twice and I'd never felt like all those chemicals like surging in my body like that ever before. I lost like my ability to speak for like a few minutes. Like my head was spinning. It was like an out of body experience and I didn't even realize what I had done, but I had screenshotted all the messages and I had sent them to her saying, I can't believe you'd do this. And I had sent them to her husband, who I was also friends with, saying, I think, you know, they're having an affair. And then I just sat there for a couple more minutes, just watching my husband sleep, thinking like that moment, like before where I like looked at him with this admiration and You just like, you can't unsee something like that. So then I woke him out of his slumber and, you know, just asked like, how long have you been having an affair? And like the look in his eyes just was like confirming of everything like I'd already seen.
So how long had it been going on?
Well over a year.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was interesting because she like right away denied everything. Like we crossed the line. It was flirtation. Nothing happened. Like, you know, my phone was just going off and I just put it down. I didn't even look again until the next day. But with him, like he couldn't actually answer anything. He wouldn't speak. All he kept saying was, I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to hurt you. And like 8 hours had gone by. So like I woke him up at 11 and we were still having this circular conversation with really me only speaking by six in the morning. And, you know, for me though, it was that night was a test in itself because I had sort of already told myself if he lies to me even once about this, like it's over.
Right.
And so as much as it was excruciating to like pull information out of him, I think in some ways it was comforting that it's almost like there was this sense of relief in him.
Mm-hmm.
That it had finally been brought to the surface, because I don't know if he would have ever mustered up the courage to tell me. Like, I feel like I always had to end that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. I'm catching my breath. I know you are too. That's, I'm sorry. I don't even know what to say. 'Cause that's just, I've been there and I don't, anybody who has never been through it can't understand.
No, they can't. You can't. I know, like, I've been through a lot in my life, estrangement of my mom, best friends dying, like things like that. And betrayal though, it's a trauma that it's so unlike other traumas, because it not only like, you're not only sad about whatever the loss is or the thing you've gone through, but it's like this decimation of yourself.
Right.
Right.
And, like, and it's, yeah. And I always, people always say it's not like somebody died, and I'm like, no, I think somebody kind of did.
Your whole future died too.
Your future died. But I always look at it and you say, you've got the husband, you've got the wife, and then you've got the partnership between them. And that partnership has now been severed or broken. So that third member of your marriage,
yeah,
kind of ceased to exist, yeah, or ceases to a certain extent at least.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, wow. Again, I'm so sorry, but tell me, so you're talking all night. He never denies it. It doesn't sound like he like jumped up and down and started volunteering information, but he at least answered your questions, mm-hmm, as you brought him up.
Obviously, things weren't great. You know, it was a little too close to home. Like having an affair is one thing. Having it with someone's best friend and also neighbor, it changed every dynamic of my life. We had to, like, the first thing was I was living in what felt like an emotional torture chamber because I had to see her every day, multiple times a day. Our kids went to the same school, like all of those things. And so, you know, having to decide, like, I can't live here. I can't heal here, all of those things. So those are some of the first thoughts of going through my mind of, what do we do now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. What do you do?
Yeah. And for someone like me who, like, super organized, I always have a plan. It was the first time in my life that, you know, similar to you, Tom, like, I kind of fell to my knees, like, thoughts racing. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no plan. I can scheme my way out of anything. And I was thoughtless in like what I was going to do. And it's funny because I always told myself if someone ever cheated on me, there would be no questions asked. They would be out the door. And it's just so interesting because you really don't know until you're in the experience. But it was never a pathway that I really felt like I wanted, if that makes sense. Like I felt like we could fix this and save this. Did it make it any easier? Absolutely not. But I still had no idea, like, how was I going to rebuild myself, our marriage? Where were we going to live? Like all of those things.
Yeah. So it's really great that we've had this conversation up to this point, that you've completely owned up to the things that you feel that you had any control over that led up to a chasm in your marriage.
Right.
But I'm very public about my belief that did not cause an affair. People always say, what, it takes two to have an affair. No, it only takes two to have an affair because you need an affair partner. Mm-hmm. Tess, you didn't cause the affair. Tori and your best friend caused the affair.
Yeah.
But it does take two to repair a marriage.
It does.
And so you and Tori have this conversation all night long. Mm-hmm. Were decisions made?
Yeah, we didn't make any decisions that night. I was still in shock and in some ways denial, right? You know, I've done a lot of research on psychology and like neuroscience and how the brain works. And for me, like I had so much confirming evidence of this amazing trusted friend and all this confirming evidence of like this loyal, trusting, sweet husband, that like this new reality did not sync with that, you know? And I think like even that morning, like after my hour of sleep, I woke up thinking like, wow, that was the craziest nightmare. I know it's reality. And now I have two toddlers awake and mommy has to put on a brave face in front of that. And right, it's so different. Like, I don't think kids are ever a reason that you should stay in an unhappy marriage or something, but wow, does it really, like, it is so hard, like, with children, because you don't get to grieve right away. Like, you have to hide it almost, right? And you don't get to feel all the emotions of like, what you just went through. So that next day, I told him, like, you need to leave. Like, go to your parents, wherever you need to go. But, like, I need some space to think. And then, you know, days went by, we continued having conversations. I still hadn't said whether or not I was going to ask for a divorce or not. And it's so weird too, because like even 4 days later, it almost sounds like sick, but it's like this wedge was like imploded. Like the wedge was gone. Like I knew what the issue was. And it's like all of a sudden I became like super attracted to him, almost like territorial, I would say, in a way. Like I wanted to like reclaim my husband. It was like the weirdest thing. I was like, wow, this is weird. I wonder if anyone else experiences this.
Now I do too.
But you know, I think like in that week that had surpassed, we had probably some of like the deepest, most real, vulnerable conversations that we had ever had in our entire relationship.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, they needed to happen, obviously.
Yeah. Like not even just about like the current situation, but like, you know, like his childhood or my childhood and like things we liked, things we didn't like where we fell off track, all those things, which, you know, I wish like those were conversations we had always had, but maybe it took something like that to really break us open. And I think that's like where that sort of like re-sparking of like that love came from, because I could almost see him in this new light. Like he was finally being like fully open and vulnerable, because like what else did we have to lose at that point? Right.
Right.
Like
good point.
All our cards were on the table. Like I wasn't holding back like things that I really didn't like or things that I really wanted in life that I felt like he was holding me back from, or all like those types of things, those conversations. And yeah, and I think that was kind of those following days were the moment where I decided, no, we're going to work on this, but we're going to do it in a really different way. Because for all of my life, like since being a child myself to now being a wife and a mother, I had put everybody first. I had zero boundaries with people, obviously. Like, I could allow my best friend and my husband to be having an affair, like, without me even knowing. Like, I had zero boundaries, obviously. And I really do believe that before anyone can betray you, you have to betray yourself first. And I think, you know, me not listening to those, like, nudges inside me, me, you know, like, those couple moments I had mentioned where, like, things felt off, not really fighting for myself in those moments. Like, and again, I don't take responsibility for their actions. I agree with you 100%, Tom. Like, those are people's choices. But I can see how certain things happened, how I allowed certain behaviors to continue, right? And so I think it's important to take responsibility for the demise of our marriage. Do I think that you should go and have an affair because your marriage isn't great? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But also, like, it allowed us to really dig into, like, because I don't think people actually have affairs. I mean, maybe some people, but, like, just for the sex or the physicality of it. It's a, there's a deeper wound there. There's something else under the surface there, right?
Yeah.
And really, you know, in the following months, weeks and months, we both began individually to look into those. Like, why was I showing up the way I was in our marriage? Why was he and separate from each other? Because I think when things like this happen or any traumatic experience in a marriage, the first thing we want to think of is, okay, how do we repair us? That middle piece you talked about. And like, I had tried that before in my last marriage, and I was already trying that in this marriage, like seeing the counselor, and none of it was working. And I realized, like, how can I repair us when I'm broken and when he is obviously broken? Because I don't think you can say that you're unwounded if you're going and having an affair on your wife, which, you know, is seemingly pretty, like, your life's pretty happy. Like, so that was kind of the turning point for us. And that's when, you know, it all sort of, like, the plan kind of started coming together.
When did all this happen?
The affair?
Yeah. When did you find out about the affair?
And in May. So spring. Which month was that? Of 2021.
Oh, wow. So
yeah, we're a year in. We're a year into recovery, Tom.
13, 14 months ago. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this is raw. So you've tried this marriage counseling before. And like you say, that's like, it's like trying to fix a leak from the outside. You know, you've got to fix the pipe itself. You can't just put tape around it. Not that I'm a plumber or anything, but you've got to fix the underlying problem. And it sounds like the two of you recognized, or maybe you, I don't know, but you came to the realization that the problem maybe with your individual selves, before you can fix the couple, you got to fix the individuals. That's monumental. Yeah. You're literally the first person that's been on the show that's talked like that.
I don't think I had another choice. I mean, I think you have a couple pathways after something like this happens. Like, one, you leave and you stay the same, and most likely you end up in a very similar relationship because you haven't fixed anything. So right. you're attracting the same type of person, most likely. Two, you stay and you don't change anything. And then you just end up in this resentful, toxic marriage. Like, a lot of people do, because they just believe, like, we said I do, or we have kids. And like, that seems like relationship purgatory, or, you know, to me, like, doesn't seem fun. And then the third, I think, is like that you stay together, but big shifts have to happen, and not with one partner, but both. And you also, if you're willing and your partner isn't, that won't work either. Like, you can lead a horse to water, can't force them drink. And so in those months leading up to it, I still hadn't really decided what I was doing with my marriage. All I knew is I needed to save myself right now, and I needed to figure out, like, what I wanted in life, what I wasn't getting, what was holding me back, like, what were my toxic behaviors and patterns, and then we'll see. And when I started doing that work, he started doing that work, simultaneously, but independently of me. And then honestly, like, we've never been back to couples counseling, but the middle part, glued itself back together. Like, am I saying that I don't have hard days still? Absolutely not. You know, there's still really hard times or moments that I, like, my breath gets taken away, like an intrusive thought about that. But it's just, it's miraculous how, like, us working on each other, we're showing up as the best versions of ourselves. And people ask me all the time, like, well, once a cheater, always a cheater. How do you know he'll never do it again? And I don't know that. But I do know that he is probably more healed now than he ever was in our relationship, right?
Yeah, I get that, you know, all the time. Since I forgave my wife.
Right.
I forgave her of her first affair. It wasn't until the second one that it was, yeah, I think it's time to leave. By the way, I was willing to forgive the second one, which I never thought possible, but she wasn't willing to even give it a shot. So ultimately, she's the one who decided to leave, even though she's the one, you know, I was willing to forgive, which again, I kind of look at myself now and think, what the hell? But the thing is, there's power in forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And there's power in the knowledge that you can survive it. So like you said, you never know for sure. And to everyone listening who think, oh, my partner would never cheat. Okay, first off, you don't know that. In fact, you don't know if they already have or have not. Mm-hmm. And you may never know until you're dead, standing in front of God, and he says your partner was faithful or not.
Right.
The fact is, you can't know.
No,
and what you can know is that you're powerful enough to survive. And there's the power right there.
Yeah, and I think, like, a lot of my work was reestablishing that relationship with myself rather than creating this reliance on the external world or external relationships to me, is that, like, I am enough and I'm strong enough and I know who I am and I know what I'll put up with and what I won't. And I don't think I'd ever built that relationship with myself because I never had that chance to do as a child growing up in the environment that I did. And so, yeah, exactly that. Like, people are like, well, how can you continue on? It's like, because I feel like people shouldn't be judged by their mistakes. I've made mistakes in my life. I think repeated toxic behavior, like what you described from your wife, like, that's a different story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if anybody listening hasn't figured it out yet, the crazy part of our story today is the fact that Tess and Tori are still together. So we're 13, 14 months into this traumatic situation. Yeah. Let's talk about what's happened during that time period and where you are and what the goals are for the future. So you left the neighborhood. I know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were going to just, you know, rebuy another house in the same city. And then I began sort of this kind of self-healing journey, as did he. And I realized, like, I just needed a really big change in my life, like temporary, because I had never given myself, like, I'd never made myself a priority. And when you go through something like that, going back to work full time, still caring for two kids, all of those things, like, it leaves little room to do some pretty major, like, upheaval in your life, which I felt was something that was really required. And, you know, people who know me were absolutely shocked. I said, I'm actually going to take a year off work, like a sabbatical. Wow. We're going to move to, like, a mountain town, like a small town, like, uproot our kids. We're going to leave our whole family back in the city where we grew up, like our whole support network for our children. And yeah, that's what we're going to do. And, like, my husband wanted to do it. And we just wanted to be, like, this family of four and continue on our journey. And honestly, it's been really hard, but it's probably been, like, the best thing that I've ever done in my life, because I've healed so much. I've, like, rediscovered who I am. We've discovered who, like, we both are and as a couple. And, you know, I've learned how to set boundaries with people. I've shared my story on social media. Not that, like, I want this to be a defining moment, but it was the catalyst that has now changed my life. Like, and so in a way, like, I actually am thankful for it. Do I wish it could have been some other thing? Probably, yeah. Sure. But, like, I do feel like some event like this needed to kind of, like, bring me down to my knees and break me open, as well as our marriage. And so we moved to this mountain town, and yeah, like, we're kind of coming up to the end of that and most likely moving back to our city later on this fall. But yeah, I really felt like I needed a reprieve away from everyone to really focus on myself. I started like a podcast similar to like you, just to help people with their, you know, like not necessarily just relationships or divorce talk or crazy stories, which is fun, but just more on like what I've learned along this like 1 year journey about like rebuilding myself, because that's the hardest part of it. It's not the rebuilding of the marriage. I find it's like the rebuilding of your self-worth and who you are and all of that.
What's the name of your podcast?
It's Authentically Wild.
Authentically Wild. Okay. I don't mean to take us back to the traumatic part here before, but I want to know, how did you get into his phone? Did you know passwords, or did you like hold it up and do facial recognition?
Well, that would have been smart. I don't feel like I would have thought of that, but no, I knew his password. So okay. Again, like, you know, I didn't feel that he was hiding anything, because I always had full access. Even my husband was a firefighter, and a couple other jobs where like he could go in the middle of the night, and sometimes I'd wake up and be like, like, did you make it home safe? And so like I even had like location tracker on, like I could see where he was at any moment in time for that specific reason, right? Because his job would call him out in the middle of the night to fight fires and things.
When did they have time to have this affair?
Yeah. You know, I still don't really know. Like that night everything happened, I asked a lot of questions like that. And as I got answers, I began to feel worse and worse and worse. You know, like I would be at work, he would get home before me. If I'd go on like girls' weekends, like it wasn't an affair that was just like a full year of an affair. It was on, off, because I think the guilt in both of them ate them alive, like where they came to conclusions like we can't do this. This is stupid. And I should preface too, and I do truly believe this, they weren't having an affair because they were in love with each other, or that they wanted to be together. They were having an affair because they both were wounded in very different ways. Like Tori, with I mentioned like this abandonment, and he needed to feel needed by someone, and I wasn't available for that. Mm-hmm. She had like very low self-worth in her confidence and physical appearance, even though she's gorgeous and funny and all of those things. And so it was like this mutual means to get their needs met, right? Yeah. They felt important, they felt special, but like that was never their end goal, was to like leave their marriages. And so you could tell like it would be like on, off. So again, just in terms of like, when did it happen? Like it was sporadic. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
So it wasn't 12 months of just going for it. It was 12 months of, or 6 months. How long was it?
Just over a year.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was 12 months of every once in a while here and there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter. Once is enough.
Exactly. And, you know, I'd say I heard, I don't know if you're familiar with Esther Perel, but she's a good psychologist. And she talks a lot about how people, you know, back in the 50s and 60s who had affairs, like you'd find like lipstick on a collar or a receipt, but that was all you'd know. And so like you didn't have these like vivid, you know, details about it, which she says like, know enough, but then stop there, because it's not going to be helpful to you. Because, you know, like I could see messages. Like I knew my best friend so well. Like I knew every like inch of her. Like I can visualize every single piece of how this went. So like in a way, it's like being in a 3D movie with like those seats that, you know, like you feel it. Like it's not like I could just like my imagination, you know, or some person I didn't know.
Yeah.
Like, so it makes it even worse. That'll be another piece for people. Like maybe just don't dig too much, because you don't really, it doesn't help you.
Yeah. When I found out, I wanted to know everything, and
most people do. Like I did.
And that's, it's a mistake.
Yeah.
I asked too much.
Yeah.
And I got too much. Now I knew her affair partner. Mm. We were friends, not as close as you and your friend, but yeah. So I get it. I couldn't close my eyes without seeing that video playing of them together. And it is painful. And by the way, that I don't know if you're talking about that TED Talk or one of her books, but she did this amazing TED Talk. Esther Perel did. Mm-hmm. And I watched this thing, and the last like 30 seconds of it kind of changed my entire outlook on life. And she said, most of us will have 4 or 5 intimate relationships in our life. And if we're lucky, they're all with the same person.
Yeah.
And I just went, Oh, I love that. I wish I would have heard that 30 years ago.
I know. And you know, like, actually, it's funny because I think of that talk she gave a lot, because I almost feel like we're in this new marriage now. Like, this is like our second marriage to each other. Right. Yeah. And it feels like, yeah, it's like a, not a clean slate, but it's like a redo, where we're really giving it all we have this time around. You know what I mean? Like, we've really come into who we each are and the wounds we both carry. And yeah. And it's something different for sure.
And so I asked before the show if we could, you know, what we were going to call your husband, because this has got to be embarrassing for him. And Tori is his real name, and he is supportive of everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
Which, that says a lot about his wanting to fix things.
Yeah. I mean, even when I first shared my story on social media, like, I had to ask him, like, are you okay with that? Because as much as it's like, you know, it feels embarrassing for me, like, you kind of are a villain in it. Like, not yeah. that I painted him that way, but, and he was like, I'll do anything and support you any way you need to heal. Like, and seeing like the outcry of like women and even men, like saying like, oh, thank you for sharing this. Like, cause you know, there's actually not a lot out there on people who have affairs and then they stay together. Like, I actually got so much judgment from that. And it's just been like, that's why I do it now, is to share like that you can do it. Do I know what the future holds? Absolutely not. But, you know, I feel like there's not enough support, and that's really why I do it. And also just to tell people, like, something like that doesn't have to be detrimental to your life. Like, it is in the moment, but you can rebuild and create something better, whether it's just you or you with your partner. And so trying to be an example, and yeah, he's been really supportive. I'm writing a book. I mentioned I do the podcast, and just to share like my story of really rediscovering myself and like prioritizing myself and how every other piece of my life, my marriage included, has just sort of expanded and met me now where I'm at because of that.
So unlike those online who say, you know, once a cheater, always a cheater, and they judge you for forgiveness and for acceptance, my respect for you is through the roof, that you are willing to do the forgiveness, to do the acceptance, but also to talk about it. And I don't have a lot of tolerance for infidelity, but the fact that he's willing to own up to it, I will tell you, please pass along to Tori, respect through the roof.
Oh, thanks, Tom. I will.
Where are you now in your marriage? Because you fixed yourself. I guess that's a lifelong thing. You have worked on fixing yourself and repairing your stuff. And so has he. So how does that change the dynamic in the relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think first, like when we first dove into kind of our own healing journeys, it was becoming aware, like, how are we showing up? All of those things, healing kind of our past childhood wounds, his abandonment issues, my like controlling perfectionist ways. And then through that, like, we've began to have, you know, discussions about like, hey, when you do this, it actually like really hurts me or it really bugs me. Whereas before, we would have never, first of all, discussed it in that way. It would have been like passive aggressive comments or explosive fights or, you know, like, you left your clothes on the floor again. But it's not about the clothes. It's about like, you know, coming together as a partnership, not like a parent child. And so we've just been able to have these way like deeper, more transparent conversations, as well as like parenthood, as you know, it's extremely difficult. Like, nobody gives you a manual, and it can break you apart as a couple. Mm-hmm. And so that's been another really big piece for us. Like, right now we're working on like parenting our kids different than how we were parented. Like, you know, we were both under like fear-based parenting, myself especially. And that works to like change behavior, but it severely damages people. Like, I can be the first to admit. You know, and really using it as this like thing that bonds us together as opposed to tears us apart. And also just like me kind of pursuing some of my creative like dreams, and like Tori like really stepping up to the plate as a father and as a husband. Like, who he is now is so different than who he was. And I think in the first, you know, 3 or 4 months of this journey, I kind of thought like, well, we'll see how long this lasts, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's also been a lot about like me getting my ego aside. Like I'll be the first to admit, like I was not a perfect wife. Like I was demeaning, controlling, like I was loving and all those things. And people will tell you like, oh, you're perfect. You have nothing to change. But that's just a crock of BS. Like people say that because they don't want to have to do the work themselves. So when they say like, oh, you're fine, it was all them. Like that's just them covering that up for themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we're just having like these deep conversations. We are prioritizing our family and our relationship. And yeah, everything else is kind of just like seamlessly coming together.
Good for you. I'm happy for you. And you know, I hear like my own story.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't. I mean, we did marriage counseling, but we did not do. I mean, she was in individual counseling when she started the affair.
Yeah.
Actually, she started the counseling because she had an affair. How weird is that? She went to her counselor, and the first thing she said to her therapist was, "I'm in an affair, and I need your help to get out."
Right.
So she understood that she was having some individual issues. I wasn't knowledgeable enough on the subject to know that I should have gone to individual therapy as well to figure out what I had done to contribute.
Right.
And so she ended up continuing her personal therapy and we had marriage counseling, but I never did personal therapy. Mm-hmm. And that I'm sure is a contributing factor to the fact that she did it again.
It may be. And sometimes healing just takes like people can go and then they see like the pieces of themselves they need to fix. And some people are like, absolutely not. I'm not changing the way I am. Right. And so, yeah, you never know what's contributing to it. But I think if someone's actively, you know, changing and expanding and like having honest conversations with themselves, like there's hope for them too. You know what I mean? And it maybe you guys caught it too late or whatever it was, but it doesn't work out all the time for sure. But yeah, it seems like you've learned a lot from that.
Oh boy. I've learned a lot. And by the way, since her second affair, I did do some fairly intense and long individual therapy and figured out a lot of things about myself.
Yeah.
And I do understand, and I even understood even then that I contributed to a crappy marriage. Now, how crappy it was, you know, whatever. But the point is, there was an environment in which she decided extramarital affair was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
She made a choice to do that based on the situation in our marriage, and I contributed to that situation. If you could, what are your most important lesson learned, or what advice would you give?
I think that a lot of people seem very perplexed, like whether or not they're actually considering divorce or they're just in this valley, we'll call it, in a relationship. Like, should I stay or should I go? And I really do believe like the answer is growing together. And so what I mean by that is, if there is an issue where you are considering divorce, but maybe you want to save your marriage, it will never work. It will never work if you both don't change. Because like you said, you're both contributing something to the demise of that. And I think so often we say I do, and then we assume, okay, well, all the dating stuff and all the hard work's out of the way. Like, we're good. We got this contract and that's bulletproof. And let me fucking tell you, it is not.
Yep.
Right. And, you know, we get lazy like as humans. And so I think those are like the two pieces, like never stop dating each other and putting in the effort, no matter 10, 20 years in, 6 kids, I don't care. Because if you deprioritize that marriage, like it will become deprioritized and it will break apart. And then second is, if you've gone through something like you and I have, Tom, or any kind of trauma like that, and you want to save it, it only works if you both are willing to put in the work. I see it lots on my social media, like, I want to, but my husband doesn't, or I do, but my wife doesn't. Well, that's your answer. Like, there's the door, see them out, because it will not work if they aren't willing to change as well. Like, it can work, but again, you'll be in that like relationship purgatory, like I called it. And so, you know, you only have one life, and if this is your person and your best friend, that's what you committed to at marriage, like show up for it. And if it gets into a valley, like you both have to be willing to admit your fault. And that's really hard for people. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, I maybe said sorry to my husband like 3 times throughout our entire relationship. Like, he was always at fault for any argument, anything, because like, I was not willing to ever admit fault, right? Because again, like, I'm a perfectionist. Like, I can't be wrong. It was my way or the highway. And there's so many people who live their lives like that. And I think it gets magnified in their intimate partnerships. And that's that deteriorates your trust, like your bond, all of that. And so, and the couples counseling thing, if you think that you can show up in couples counseling and have your partner tell you all the things that you're bad at or you're doing wrong or the ways you're not enough, and you haven't figured those out for yourselves yet, like, how do you think that's going to go?
Good point.
Because it's not going to go well. And so, like, I guess what I'm really trying to say here is, like, become self-aware. Because, yeah, like, if you're not, you're not going to receive it well from your partner. But so many people don't want to, right? It's too hard and it feels too vulnerable.
Tess, thank you. Thank you for your maturity. Thank you for your forgiveness, for your self-awareness, and thanks, for being willing to share. This is hard.
Yeah. I hope. Yeah, that's really my intent, is to help other people and give them hope if that's the route that they want to go. And if not, I guess there's also our divorce if you really need to go through with it, right? Quit trust us. Right.
Unfortunately, not in Canada, but yes.
Yeah.
Someday, maybe.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. My heart truly hurts for Tess, but I'm so glad to learn that Tori is all in on fixing things between them and that they're both all in on fixing themselves. As she just said, become self-aware. My interpretation of that is simple. Don't expect your partner to fix their shit until you're willing to fix yours. Oh, and if you don't think you need fixing, think again. If you want to hear more from Tess, I've included links to all her social media and to the Authentically Wild podcast in the show notes. I hope you'll follow her and show her some support. If you like today's show, please show it by giving us 5 stars on whatever app you're using right now. It really helps us spread the word. Have an amazing week, everyone. Bye.
It's a great day, I'm feeling good. Oh, the possibilities of what I could, oh, do with the world at my fingertips. My imagination brings a smile up to my lips.
Divorce doesn't have to be complicated. Our Divorce.com's 3-step procedure provides a simple and affordable process that you can follow at your own pace. Save thousands by visiting ourdivorce.com today.